Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Notable.
Hello, welcome to Notable with me, Elizabeth Holker.
And me, Stu McConey.
And we're around the table at our producer Jeff's incredible house in Macclesfield.
It's lovely. We're around the kitchen table, so you might hear passing
cars. Police cars.
Tramp steamer.
Yeah.
Macclesfield being on the Maritime Highway.
Yeah. Exactly. And
we're going to tell you some more about two interesting, curious tales from the world of music
and the
history and culture that surrounds music as well.
Absolutely. So shall we get started?
Why don't you? What are you going to tell me?
Okay, so the first story, the one that I'm going to tell you about, Stuart, is this rumour that's been kicking around since 1969 that Paul McCartney is, in fact, dead. Paul is dead.
The Paul is dead rumour.
Yeah. So I first came across this when I was a student at Leeds University, and I did a history of art module. We could kind of pick and choose from other departments to make up our credits. And we were studying kind of iconography, mostly about what different fruits and animals meant in Frans Hals paintings.
Right.
But
what
I
do
think,
they mean? And that's a separate podcast,
I can't,
is it?
Yeah. Right. I know a dog is obviously the sign of fidelity and...
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Right.
Yeah. I'll bring some more next week.
Great. But it was a wide-ranging course.
It was.
As well as this, you did.
Yeah, we looked at the front of Abbey Road.
Okay.
The cover of Abbey Road.
The Beatles album.
Yeah, the Beatles album. And our professor, Professor Richard Howells, said, this is a funeral procession. You know how they're all kind of crossing over on the zebra crossing, very famous.
Absolutely.
Cover. John is leading the way. He's dressed in white. He's a priest.
Right.
Ringo is next. He's dressed all in black. So he's the funeral director.
Yes.
Paul is third and he's barefoot, which is apparently a sign of being dead. And he's smoking as well. He's got
he's
a cigarette in
the
wrong hand.
Because he's famously left-handed. Yep. And his cigarette's in his right hand, which we'll explain the
significance
of that in a minute, that it's not the real Paul.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And behind is George, who is the gravedigger.
In denim.
In denim.
Which I've never quite
exactly.
got. I didn't really understand that denim was grave digger word, but I suppose it means like work gear, doesn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. Yeah.
And so Richard Howells looks at us all and he said, so as you can see from this cover, Paul is dead. And we were like, no, he's not. And he said, how do you know? And we were like, because he's still alive.
Right.
We've met him, Stuart.
Okay. Let's declare an interest here. We've met Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
And we had a really nice time with
we
him.
Did.
He was lovely. We hung out in his dressing
peanut.
Room. He gave us a chocolate peanut. We've hung out in his dressing room. He was very sweet to us. We've got pictures of us with him.
Yeah.
But according to the Paul is dead rumour, which still some people believe.
They do.
That is not Paul McCartney.
No.
That's a guy called Billy Shears.
Yeah, or William Campbell.
Or William Shears
yeah,
Campbell.
Yeah, Campbell, exactly. All kinds of variations.
Who was recruited by the Beatles. Before we go into all the iconography and clues, should we say what
the
story
is? Yeah. So the rumour started in 1969. The conspiracy is basically that Paul died in 1966. He got in his car on the 9th of November that year, after storming out of sessions for Sgt. Pepper, drove off, crashed and died. In a huff.
That's right.
What the Beatles did then was cover the whole thing up, replaced him with one of their mates who happened to also look like Paul and went on to write Blackbird and all those other famous form wings.
That's a very good point, yeah. That's a very good point.
So maybe this guy should have been the original Paul
anyway. They wrote them in. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. And his name was William Shears, as you say, William Shears Campbell or William Shepherd, sometimes Billy Shears as well, who's mentioned on Sgt. Pepper. So there were a few kind of incidents that... I'm not even going to say gave any legitimacy to this, but that made people think that there'd been a crash of some sort. There were two crashes, kind of loosely connected to Paul.
Right.
He did actually crash his moped in December 1965.
Wow, this is good
he
research.
He had a chipped tooth. So in the video for Paperback Writers, he has a chipped tooth and he has a scar on his lip, which he sort of covered with a moustache. Then in 1967, Paul's Mini Cooper was involved in an accident.
Right.
It was being driven by a Moroccan student called Mohamed Hajij.
Okay.
From a party involving Richards, Jagger. They were all
guys.
On their way to, yeah, we were following behind as well in our own Mini Cooper, of course. Yeah, they were off to Richard's country house and this student crashed Paul's Mini. It was a write-off. The student ended up in hospital. Paul wasn't present. But suddenly all these rumours started flying around that Paul had died.
They start on American campuses, don't they, I think?
They do.
College campuses. Yeah. People start, jocks on college campuses start to say, hey, that's not Paul McCartney, man, you know.
Yeah, so the way it gathered speed, in 1969, November that year, a radio presenter called Russ Gibb, it's a very kind of American jock DJ name, that, isn't it?
I'm Russ Gibb.
Yeah. He got a call on his show, which was on a station, it was WKNR-FM in Michigan. The caller was called Tom, mysteriously.
Right.
I mean, it's not that much of a weird, mysterious name, but there was no surname.
Okay.
And he claimed that McCartney was dead. I was thinking this, like, imagine if someone called your show on Six Music and said, my name's Tom, and I don't know, I don't want to say any names of, you know, pop stars and say they're dead. But, you know, everyone would think that was really strange. It'd be unlikely they'd even get past the producer and on air, isn't it?
That's right. The bits I've looked into about this thing, that there was just some kind of weird climate in America at the time. It was Vietnam.
Yeah.
It was an era of... Everybody had this thing about the man and the establishment and they're not telling
conspiracy
us things, man, and conspiracies. And
it
just fed this kind of weird vibe on American campuses. They're like, that's not Paul McCartney, man. You know, except the Beatles are the man in this case.
Was
because
it the drugs that people were taking?
I don't know, but this...
The whole kind of Cold War
but
atmosphere.
But it is strange that it got...
People disappearing into mountains, like an episode of Thunderbirds
or
something.
It did get credence, though, didn't it? Really quickly. And, like...
It did.
It became a phenomenon.
But it's incredible how that happened. So the guy, Tom, the famous Tom... His evidence for this was that if you play the Beatles song Revolution 9 backwards, then it's set, you know how it says number nine? Well, apparently, backwards, if you play that backwards, it's the words, turn me on, dead man.
That's right, that's the rumour. That's the rumour. There's something else
that
as well,
isn't
there?
That was the only evidence that he had.
There's another clue, isn't there, that on Sergeant Pepper, the end of Sergeant Pepper, there's that little bit at the end of Sergeant Pepper, where he says, Lennon says, I buried Paul.
Paul, yeah. There's a whole load of other stuff that came after this. But the
rumour started from just that one guy. I get you, right.
So after that, there was a man called Fred Labor. That also feels like quite a 60s American name.
Yeah.
Like the sort of person who would start a conspiracy.
Yeah.
He was listening. He was a student journalist as well. And he thought this would be fun to write up. Again, it's all quite dark, this, isn't it? Why would you do this?
I know.
He wrote up the story in his student newspaper and he said, basically, the Beatles had replaced Paul. He was the person who came up with the William Campbell idea.
Billy Shears.
And he was going to say they replaced him with a friend called Glenn Campbell, but he thought that was too obvious. He's since admitted
this. He's admitted all this, has he? Right.
So he thought, I'll change it to William. It's a bit less obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it. That's how that started. And then from that piece that he wrote, this story just basically spread around the world. At the Apple kind of press team had to keep asking Paul
Derek Taylor. Derek Taylor had to keep denying it, didn't he? And Ringo famously said, he said, this is insane. He said, but there's nothing we can do about it, really, because you can't prove, I mean, we know this is Paul McCartney and he is alive and well, but we can't prove otherwise. Because they'll just keep, because, you know, the thing about conspiracy theories is that what will ever convince people? And they just say, no, that's not him, that's not Paul McCartney. It's like I once read somewhere an interesting thing about conspiracy theories. People who believe conspiracy theories believe all of them.
Yeah.
They never believe just one. I've yet to meet someone who goes, I mean, I've yet to meet someone who says, yeah, you know, Paul McCartney's dead, you know, and Jim Morrison, he's still alive.
The Illuminati.
And then you go, what about the moon landings? And then they go, oh, yeah, we landed on the moon, obviously. They believe all of them. It's a mindset, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's the way your brain's wired, isn't it?
But it only takes a second to think through the logic of it and think,
why would there be the body?
Well, and why would the Beatles bother?
Yeah.
Some people say Jim Morrison is alive. Mm. Well, then why isn't he in Tesco's? You know, what has he got to gain from pretending to be dead?
So as someone who was born in the 80s, the more I was sort of reading into this whole conspiracy, I was just thinking, it feels very 60s. You know, that this person would appear on that radio show and say this and it would get picked up and be allowed to flourish in the way that it was and given the airtime.
Yeah. I would have to say I'm not an expert because I was in like nappies for a lot of it. But I think, yeah, like I said, there was a mood abroad about us and the man, the counterculture and the man lied to you. The man wanted you to believe certain stuff and it was like, hey, that's not what's true. You shouldn't believe everything the man tells you. And that just extended. And I think also people believed rock culture is still very young. And this doesn't quite apply to St. Paul's scenario because St. Paul is dead. But people couldn't quite believe, and you get this with Lennon and you get this with Jim Morrison, that these immortal rock gods that could do something as prosaic and ordinary as die. You know, okay. So it's no, the man's tried to silence them in some way. And that just became, the ethos of the times, that somehow we didn't know the truth and that was a worldwide conspiracy of the establishment and the military. And
There was a lot of international mistrust as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think it was the height of the Cold War. So some of that mistrust would have been completely legitimate, but not Paul McCartney being dead. Because I think the idea was that the Beatles had covered, correct me if I'm wrong, had covered up the death and the accident and then, stricken with guilt at what they'd done, had left clues everywhere, which is a weird thing to do.
Absolutely. But following this, good old Russ Gibb.
I'm Russ Gibb.
He went back and he did an hour-long special called The Beatle Plot. Spoke to all kinds of people. Spoke to someone who claimed to be Paul, who wasn't even Paul. Yeah. Other people who claimed like they knew that he died for sure. Spoke to Derek Taylor, as you say, and did this whole kind of hour-long special. So he giving it credence in some, you know, just kind of legitimising this story or giving it airtime, which, you know, is enough to make anyone think there might be something to it. The real Paul, well, we think.
Yeah,
he's
the real Paul. Let's not go down that. He is the real Paul. Yeah.
He was in, and this is partly why he kind of added fuel to the fire, because he was in semi-seclusion in his Scottish farm, which apparently he'd let go to slight kind of rack and ruin.
Yeah.
And people thought, well, it must be Scruffy because he's dead, obviously.
Yeah.
He just had his daughter, Mary, with Linda.
With Linda, yeah.
So he wasn't really around, and he'd been very much like in the media all the time before then. So people did also think he'd disappeared.
Yes.
Lennon was promoting the wedding album at the time. So much to his annoyance, he kept being asked about it.
Yes.
And just, you can find online interviews with him, and he's just so bemused by this story and also really annoyed that people just keep asking him on his promotional trail about it.
Yeah.
So Apple had to ask Paul for a statement while he was up in his Scottish farm. He gave them a very famous one. It was words by Mark Twain. Rumours of my death have been greatly exaggerated. And he also said, if I was dead, I'm sure I'd be the last to know about it.
Yeah. There's a couple more clues, perhaps we should mention as well.
Yeah,
people who are clue hunters. Like, there's the car parked on the Abbey Road sleeve that says 28 if, which people have said that would be, he'd have been 28 if he'd lived. The only trouble is, he wouldn't. He'd have been 27.
Yeah.
The maths don't work. But then people said, oh no, but in the Hindu religion, babies are born at the age of one.
Yes.
So they were really keen to find some logical explanation for all this.
Yeah. Also, people thought that walrus is Greek for corpse.
Did they?
Yeah.
As in I am told, the walrus was Paul.
Yeah, actually it's Scandinavian for corpse.
Oh, right.
Apparently,
I am the walrus.
Is what Humpty Dumpty says in Finnegan's Wake before he has his fatal fall, but again, not true.
Okay.
But that's one, but that that's was another one, yeah, thing that people said. And I Am the Walrus obviously ends with the BBC broadcast of the fatal scene from King Lear, which John is true, but John just apparently liked it, and that's why they used it.
Yeah, yeah. It's had such currency, though, and such credence. I mean, the Ruttles reference it. You know, on the Ruttles movie, they reference it, because Stig, the quiet one in the Ruttles, who's actually based on George Harrison, so it doesn't quite work, but they'd start the Stig is dead rumour. And because one of the things is that if you play one of the tracks backwards, it says, I buried Stig. But then they say, no, it's Iberato Stigati, which is bad Spanish for have you a water buffalo? So they parody. And even Paul McCartney himself has referenced the thing, because he made a live album in 2010, I think, called Paul Is Live. So I think even he's referenced it, which shows he's a good sport, if nothing else.
When he appeared on the front of Life magazine with his wife and daughters, it was, the whole thing was, you know, here's Paul McCartney, he's still alive, basically.
Yeah,
they felt like they had to do that.
Yeah.
So it is incredible. But like I was saying before, if he died in 1965, I mean, that's pretty early on, isn't it? We've had a lot of whoever this William Campbell guy is since then.
Since then.
He wouldn't have got married, wouldn't have formed Wings.
The band The Beatles could have been.
Yeah, exactly. Never wrote Hey Jude.
Yeah.
Never got fined for cannabis possession.
No. I do distinctly remember, because in the late 1960s, I was at primary school, and I distinctly remember Anne Ruddy, even remember her name. Hi, Anne, if you're listening. Anne Ruddy coming to me one playtime and saying, Paul McCartney's dead. And I said, no, he's not. She said, yeah, he is. He's died. He's died. So, you know, got this. And now I realise.
Did she listen to Ross Gibb?
I don't think she was an avid listener. I guess older brothers and sisters, maybe reading the NME, picked up the story and told her.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and, but it had even reached a council estate in Wigan by 1969. Wow. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
There were interviews on Radio 4 about it. I think Derek Taylor had to go on the midday programme on Radio 4 and like morning TV. So it was in the media here, for sure, mainstream media.
Yeah, but to conclusively
out there
end this rumour now, we have had a chocolate peanut with him in his dressing room in Manchester. Yep. Paul McCartney is alive and well.
He's alive and well, yeah.
Hey, here's the thing. What about we have a moment here for a notable exception?
Great idea.
Which is a little fact, a one-off, a unique event that's not big enough and not detailed enough and storied enough to go into a lot of time and trouble over, but it's just an interesting fact. I've got one for you.
Come on.
Do you know what the only instrumental is the Beatles released?
No, come on.
It's called Flying from the Magical Mystery Tour soundtrack. It's got some gliders flying. And out of the whole Beatles catalogue, that is their only instrumental. So that's a good...
Great
pub
fact.
Quiz type fact. Yeah.
Notable exception.
Also, if you, that's you listeners, have got a notable exception,
get in touch at NotablePod on Twitter.
Absolutely. Any little facts you want to share with us at NotablePod.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Elizabeth, let's talk dates.
Okay.
There are some significant, momentous, pivotal dates in history. 1066, yep. Battle of Hastings, the Norman Conquest. 1805, Trafalgar. 1815, Waterloo. 1605, Gunpowder Plot, etc., 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 etc. But there are some significant musical years, would you think?
Do
you think
76? Punk?
Yes, 67, the Summer of Love.
Yeah. Second Summer of Love.
Second Summer of Love. 87, the Second Summer of Love.
Yeah.
If you're a jazz fan, you will probably think the most significant year in the history of jazz is 1959. It was this extraordinary year when jazz changed, not in one direction, but in several different directions, thanks to several different albums by different people, but all within a short space of time, crunched into this one year, which has now made it the year that jazz changed, the most important year in the history of jazz. And it's just an interesting story, I think. Why it should be, there weren't any particularly great socio-economic reasons about 1959. You know, the 50s were just, they were a time of kind of relative peace and prosperity in America. There were the stirrings of civil rights and things like that. But there's any particularly significant reason, unlike, say, 76 and punk rock, where you've got Britain in the grip of an economic crisis, where you've got mass unemployment and all this adds to this vibe of, you know, something's got to change and anarchistic. I don't think there's any particular reason why 59 should have had this kind of significance. But there are, depending how many you want, Seb. Some people think that there are six big albums in that year. But for the sake of speed and just were they leaders, there are definitely four. Kind of Blue by Miles Davis. Mm. The biggest selling jazz album ever, if you don't count Keith Jarrett's Cologne Concerts on ECM, which is an improvised piano album, which I think has sold almost as many, but it's whether you class that as jazz or not.
Okay.
Certainly the straight ahead, the biggest selling of the what you might call a straight ahead jazz album is Kind of Blue by Miles Davis. Before that, the dominant kind of music in jazz has been this thing called bebop,
Yep.
Which is kind of almost like the prog of the jazz world. It's fast, it's very technically demanding and virtuosic, lots of chords. You can hear the chords changing all the time, usually played by the piano, behind these soloists. The greatest exponent, Charlie Parker. Bird.
Yeah. And Miles Davis was in his band.
Davis.
Yeah. I was going to say, was Charlie Parker a big part of this? Because he was this point of confluence, wasn't he, for jazz? And
he was.
He was influenced by all different kinds of music. He was a big fan of Edgar Varese. I know he followed him around Greenwich Village asking him for lessons, and or was too afraid actually to ask him for lessons, and then finally plucked up the courage and did. But, you know, that influence, I suppose, changed the sound of jazz, didn't it?
Well,
the rhythm of jazz.
Absolutely. Parker's the main guy before 59. In a way, it's like he's dominant. In rather the same way, I guess you could say, it's a stretching the analogy a bit, but when the punks come along and they say, you know, the Beatles and the Dylans and the Stones have had their day, in a way, what happened in 59 is a reaction against Parker, because he's been the head. He and bebop have been the dominant music of jazz since the late 1940s. Like you said, Miles Davis played in Charlie Parker's band, did all this super. In fact, there's a track called Donna Lee, which people think is the classic bebop track that Miles Davis claims he wrote for Charlie Parker.
Okay.
And it's almost, and it's incredibly fast and frenetic, coming out of New York.
Charlie Parker, though, he died, of course, in 1955. Aged only 35, but he'd packed a lot into those 35 years, hadn't he?
He certainly had. And also, because he's dead now as well, so there is a kind of vacuum, a gap waiting to be filled. Where's the new direction in jazz now that the main guy of bebop has gone? Yeah. Okay. People certainly start to think, particularly Miles Davis, it's run its course by 1959. Where are we going to go next with this music? And what he does, now you're a musician, so you'll know this. What he does, he says, instead of having these fast chord changes, he goes back, he studies a few technical manuals on modes.
Yeah.
Now, you correct me if I'm wrong, but modes are essentially scales, aren't they?
Yeah. They're more simple scales. They're very... A lot of early music was modal.
That's right.
But Dorian mode, Aeolian mode.
And I think if you start on C and go da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that's one mode. That's... Is that Dorian? I think it is. But if you start on E, the same sequence of notes, that becomes... Phrygian, I think, and there's Mixolydian. So there's these seven different modes. And what Miles Davis says is, let's stop having these frenetic chord-based music and let's play music based... Because each of the modes has a characteristic feel, enigmatic, sad, bright. And he starts to make music, or he starts to want to make music based on these modes. And what comes out of that is this record, Kind of Blue. That set the template, really, for things coming. It's suddenly you've got a new kind of jazz. It's cool.
It's more emotional.
It has this air of sophistication and mystery, helped by, of course, his playing, because he's got this extraordinary tone, hasn't he, Miles Davis?
Haunting, beautiful tone.
In that band as well is John Coltrane, which is extraordinary.
He has a big album that year.
Within a month, he has Giant Steps, which is a similarly huge record, and now we can set the template for a lot of jazz to come. But he's in that band, the Miles Davis band, that makes Kind of Blue. And, biggest selling jazz album ever. It still sells a couple of thousand copies a week.
Amazing,
Kind of Blue.
Really?
His idea, I guess, was to declutter jazz, and that's what he did.
Well, modal music has a simplicity to it, doesn't it?
It does.
It's kind of...
At the opposite end...
A bit more spacious.
And... Well, maybe not at the opposite end, but there's another dude knocking about. And interestingly, a guy called Dave Brubeck, who in 1959 makes an album called Time Out, which has got a really interesting genesis. The Brubeck Quartet are white, or initially were white, until they got an African-American bass player, Eugene. But this made them always, they were always more acceptable to the middle American audience.
Because he was quite a controversial figure, wasn't he?
He was.
And it was troubling, wasn't it?
They felt it was problematic that a white guy was being successful with a black music.
Yep.
But he's interesting, because he's more like a nerdy, professorial type Brubeck. He looks that way, and his band, but he used to play Southern, once they'd got a black bass player, some Southern universities would say, you can't come on stage with that guy. And he would go, well, we are, or we aren't going on.
Yep.
Has been further from a racist than Dave Brubeck himself. But people did think that especially this record, Time Out, sold black music, sort of sanitised it and sold it to middle-class white America. What it came out of, though, is really interesting. Because Brubeck was a popular jazz artist, the government, the president, came to him and said, we want you to be a cold warrior. We want you to take jazz culture to the borders of the Soviet Union.
Oh.
So he toured, the Brubeck Quartet toured Iran, Pakistan, Turkey, Poland, all those kind of buffer countries on the edge of the Soviet Union, playing to packed houses, Mr. Cool, he was known as in Poland, playing to packed houses. But what he heard out there is what we would now guess called world music. So when he came to make Time Out, which is a succession of experiments in time signatures, you know, he uses this in this music. The most famous piece, of course, is Take Five.
Yep.
Written in 5/4 time, with at the centre of it, Joe Morello, the drummer. It's the biggest selling jazz 45 of all time. It crossed over into the pop charts.
Wow.
Which when you think it's in 5/4 time and in the middle of it, there's a drum solo.
Yeah.
That was apparently Joe Morello was sitting backstage going, beating out this 5/4 riff, and they said, we'll make a tune out of that.
Okay.
But there's also a famous tune in it called Blue Rondo a la Turk, which, you know, which is based on a Turkish folk song that they heard on this tour. So bits of world music are starting to creep in as well. Critics of Time Out, even though it's a brilliant record, critics of it say the Starbucksification of jazz starts here, you know what I mean?
Okay.
And I heard one critic who said, it's a bit like Shakespeare. He's great, but it's just some of the people who like him aren't, which I think is a bit snobby.
It's just because it was popular.
And it was enormously popular, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Like you say, he was very studious about the music, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And wanted to play it right and, yeah. You know, get the sound right. And,
yeah.
And was inventive, actually, in what he was doing.
Absolutely. But that's much more of an experiment with time signature. Miles is experimenting with melody. That's experimenting with time signatures. A million miles away from Brubeck is a guy called Charles Mingus. Charlie Mingus. Mm. This great burr of a man, angry.
There's a great story about him pulling all the strings out of a piano at once, isn't there, on
that's
stage?
Right. He had an argument with his pianist and he pulled the strings of the piano out of the piano, which must take some doing. That's like turning up a telephone directory.
Yeah.
That's quite a feat.
There's some good footage of him shooting a shotgun, firing a shotgun.
Where he fires the shotgun through the plaster in his hand.
Yeah, yeah.
He was just this big, irascible burr of a man. Brilliant bass player, brilliant musician, but also, I guess, the angry young man of jazz he was thought of. You know, a bit like we had the angry young men here in the 50s, sort of literary angry young men. He was the angry young man of jazz. And what he does with his great album of 59, because he makes one as well, it's called Mingus Ah Um, yeah. He reconnects jazz with a kind of ancestry, really, of blackness, of the Afro-American heritage, of slavery. There's Wednesday Night Prayer Meeting, Better Get It In Your Soul. This is much more, this is completely the opposite of Brubeck and Miles. This is, it's angry, it's full of passion. And the most famous track on it is called Fables of, politically the most famous track, it's called Fables of Phobos, who's this guy, Orville Phobos, who had been, or Phobos if you prefer, who was the governor of Arkansas, of Little Rock, Arkansas, who fought to stop integration there. And in the end, Eisenhower had to send in the troops to get these black kids into school because Phobos wouldn't let them go. And there's these terrible scenes you can watch on YouTube, horrible things. And Mingus made a track about it, originally with lyrics saying this guy's ridiculous, preaching hate and all this, which Columbia Records said you can't put those on the album.
Really?
But it's
because
still,
of the time.
It
was
just
too controversial.
But it still works. It still works as a piece of music because it's almost comedic. It kind of makes him look like a figure of fun. Do you know the bit in Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, the invasion theme? The
Nats, I do.
The invasion theme, yeah. It's like about the banality of evil, isn't it? Because it's such a stupid tune. The da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah,
and it's supposed to evoke. It's mocking them, but it's supposed to evoke the kind of both banality and stupidity and evil of these people.
Yep.
It's a bit like that because it's a comic tune, Fables of Phobos. But it's, I think it's kind of saying, what kind of dude is this? So that is another way jazz is going.
Interestingly, I first sort of came across Charlie Mingus through Joni Mitchell.
Really?
When I was a teenager.
Her album, Mingus.
She did album in tribute to him, didn't she?
But maybe the craziest of them all, a guy called Ornette Coleman, who's a little guy from LA, makes a record in this year, 59, called The Shape of Jazz to Come.
And it's crazy to think they all came out at the same time.
I know.
Because you imagine that Ornette Coleman album was later, I think.
Oh, I think so, you're right. Yeah.
But
they're not
talking,
but they don't know each other. They're not talking to each other. They're not cross-fertilising. Brubeck's
really
having his thinking at the same time as Mingus is having his thinking and Davis is all separately. All about different bits of what jazz is.
Yeah.
But they're all having these, there's just something in the air, obviously. Coleman, there's a great story by Charlie Hayden, who's the bass player in his band, who's a white guy. So I was saying, going down to Jerry Mulligan's club in LA and seeing this little guy come and pull out a white plastic saxophone.
Yep.
And play this incredible music that he'd never
heard.
He said
he'd never seen a plastic saxophone before.
No, or heard anything like this before in his life. And basically, Jerry Mulligan stopped him because it's the beginning of what we call free jazz now. It's this wild anarchic sound.
Yep.
And Mulligan said, stop, man, that's not music. And he left. Hayden chased him, couldn't get him, tracked him down to his apartment in LA and said, I've never heard playing like that in my life before. I play bass. I'd love to make some music with you. And Ornette Coleman said, well, what about now? And they stayed for 3 days and started to make the roots of what was the Shape of Jazz to Come album. And it still sounds ferocious and amazing.
It does,
now.
I know. He wanted to kind of speak through the instrument, didn't he? It had a very kind of vocal tone.
That's right. He said, I'm not bothered with chords, I'm not bothered with keys, I'm not bothered about melodies, I'm just it's about sound.
Yeah.
I just want to make some sound on this instrument. I mean, he's technically a brilliant player.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he was taking jazz in a completely different way. So people started to hear about this guy, Ornette Coleman, and his band and what they're playing. And he makes his debut in New York at a place called the Five Spot Club in 59. For what it seems to me, it's a bit like the famous Pistols at the, you know, except the Pistols gig at the Free Trade Hall in 76 wasn't particularly divisive, was it? There was a handful of people there and they all went off to form bands. They all thought it was amazing. I think this thing at the Five Spot that Ornette Coleman did, this brief gig, this residency, I think maybe only been a couple of nights, but the people who were there said, it was totally divided. There were people queuing around the block and then people were, it's like Rite of Spring, you know, style thing. Some people said, this isn't music, what is he doing? Other people were entranced by it, but apparently it was an incredible thing. And The Shape of Jazz to Come sounds like an audacious title for this guy's record, but in a way...
Sometimes you've got to arrive with a bang, don't you? And a statement of intent.
But he was right, because of all these four, on all these four records, in a way, are The Shape of Jazz to Come in different ways. Miles is the birth of cool jazz, and I guess Dave Brubeck is the birth of, like, coffee table jazz, I guess.
Yeah.
The Charlie Mingus comes, the more politically engaged jazz that we'll see, sort of spiritual and political jazz during the 1960s. And out of Ornette Coleman comes free jazz, which still divides people today about whether it's jazz or not. I mean, I love it, but it's not for everyone. So The Shape of Jazz to Come, it's not that audacious, and kind of all those records from that amazing year, 1959, in some ways were setting The Shape of Jazz to Come. Some people would say about 1959, though, as well, that in many ways it's not a great year for jazz, because having been in some ways the dominant musical form through the 50s, particularly coming out of Black America, that 59 is when it splits, is when you get Miles Davis going into modal jazz and Ornette Coleman starting free jazz. And so in some ways, jazz never becomes a dominant force again. It becomes niche. Some people say it never, up until recently maybe, with the new generation of jazzers like Kamasi Washington and people like that. You could say that recently it diluted the appeal of jazz and rock.
It became a bit more challenging as well than it had
been. Yeah, more of an esoteric interest, yeah. I guess, a niche interest, and that rock comes along and supplants it as the main popular music of the day. So it did change jazz, but I guess there'll be some people who say maybe not completely for the better. You can tell us what you think about all this. You may be a very keen jazz fan who thinks 1959 is the year that ruined jazz. You may think kind of blues overrated. You may think free jazz is A, brilliant, B, unlistenable. Show your thoughts with us about any of these things. We have a Twitter account, @NotablePod. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, and do you think that Paul McCartney's dead or alive?
Paul, if you're listening and you'd like to come on the Notable Pod, bring some chocolate peanuts. Again, they were delicious. And we can nail this rumour once and for all.
He's on Twitter, Paul.
So he
can find us @NotablePod.
And you can find us wherever good podcasts blossom. We're called Notable Google for us. Yeah, we're blossoming somewhere on a platform near you soon. Like, subscribe, all that good stuff.
All that jazz.
All that jazz. Just leave that in, Jeff.
Notable.
The podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.